Welcome to All Sides Weekend. I'm Claire Roth, your host. Starting in just about an hour, all across the country, students will be marching for climate action. They're just the latest activists in a long history of American protest. And right now, CCAD is hosting an exhibition celebrating that history and that urge. It's called Protest the Project. It displays student-made protest signage. Julie Abijanik is a professor who worked with them on the project at CCAD, and she joins me now. Welcome, Julie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us about the idea behind this project. Why protest? Why focus on that?
Well, I think that, you know, when Tim Riedenbach, the chair of Fine Arts and Craft, took over the program, he wanted to do something a little different at the beginning of the year in a way for the students to get to know each other and meet each other. And he thought, you know, students are so hyper aware of what's going on around them that this would be a really great moment for us to bring them together, but also to talk about this idea of protest and what are they thinking about or what are the issues they're concerned with. Mm-hmm. So as they were coming together, they got to know each other, but then they started not questioning each other, but they were starting to see, oh, somebody else is interested in something else. So it became this open dialogue of interests or concerns. And so it was a time for them, for all our students to come together, but then for us to also have a conversation about what's happening around us and what do we want to protest? What do we want to, you know, make others aware of.
And I think that's so interesting because mm-hmm. a lot of times a protest is organized around a very specific principle. And mm-hmm. then, you know, everyone, for instance, makes signage according to that principle. Whereas this, it's like, what's bothering you individually? You don't need to gather 300 people bothered about one issue to make some sort of protest signage to kind of speak your truth, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was interesting to see there were students that had same concerns. There were students that had very different concerns. There was a student who actually protested that it was a waste of his time to be doing it. So they were protesting the protest. So, you know, I think it was just a moment for them to, like I said, just to have a stand in their belief system and to be able to make something about that.
Well, and you're talking about a lot of the different things that were brought mm-hmm. up, you know, that came up as these students were making these signs. What were some of the recurring themes? What did you see the most of?
You know, gender. We had issues of immigration. Climate change is a huge one. You know, the cost of school, mm-hmm. being in school and knowing the debt that they're going to have when they leave school. What else did we have? Mental health issues, you know, so it ranged from voting concerns to, you know, gun laws. It was a wide variety of concerns, which was pretty interesting.
Did you have a favorite?
There were a ton of really good ones. I mean, I thought it was really funny that the student that was protesting the protest was kind of, that was really funny.
I mean, if he's bucking against authority, isn't that such a classic hallmark of protest? And who's the bigger authority when you're a student but your teacher?
Exactly. So, I mean, it was perfect. So, you know, there were some really good ones. There was one of my colleagues did a great one that said, more possums, less cell phones.
So there was a little bit of absurdity as well.
There was. And, you know, a lot of students, there was a really beautiful, coin that it looked like a coin, but it also resembled a pill and it was about anxiety and mental health. And so there were some aggressive ones. There were some that were beautifully subtle. It was all across the board. It was really pretty incredible.
How can protest be art? How can these signages be considered as art? Because often, at least when you see them out during protests, they can be clever,
right?
But usually they're pretty dang straightforward. So how do you see these pieces of paper as art?
That's a good question, because people have different ideas or opinions about what art is in the art world. Yeah. I think anytime you're spending a moment to think about how you're going to place or design a frame of reference, something you're going to put information on, you have to kind of think about what's the best way I'm going to connect with the viewer. How do I catch their eye? What is it? So they have to plan it. Mm-hmm. So there is this artistic quality behind developing what's going to go on that surface. Some of them were just straightforward lettering, you know? So I think it just depends, you know. I don't think there's really a straight answer for that. I think that it just, each artist made specific work based on the way they approach making. which I think is very interesting and beautiful. And like we had talked about one time about the idea of, you know, like the pussy hats. It's an everyday object. And that everyday object becomes this protest banner, right? It's something that's worn every day. You don't think about a hat being something that dictates protest. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think it's this idea of something very simple, this poster board with a, you know, wood slat handle, and just that idea of kind of pushing the visuals on the board.
And you see with something like those hats, those pink hats, mm-hmm. or something like even the iconic peace sign, mm-hmm. iconography can be very important to movements, having a symbol to rally around.
Absolutely. You know, I think that that's how, I mean, I think that's how we just get around through this world, seeing things, right? So, and as visual people, that's really important for us. You know, we really connect to that visual. That's how we remember things. That's how we connect with other values or issues.
I think context is really interesting when it comes to these sorts of signs. I mean, you look at even just yesterday, this was in the news where mm-hmm. Jenny Holzer, pieces of her truisms. She's, mm-hmm. I don't exactly know her era, but all of her kind of truisms, which are these aphorisms, were scrolling on the sign at Broad and High, I believe, mm-hmm. downtown. And mm-hmm. it really caught people off guard. They didn't know the context of it at first.
Right.
But having that where you usually see news was very arresting for a lot of people. And that happens with protest signs as well, where it gets out into the public square, quite literally.
Absolutely. You know, and I think that another amazing artist that does that is Barbara Kruger, where she would install spaces of about this is my body or this is not your body. Like, I think there's when you're surrounded or when it hits you, when you're confronted with it, you have to acknowledge it. You don't have to, but I think that you do acknowledge it, and then you choose to either react or not react to it. And that's the beauty of, I think that's the beauty of protest, you know, or being the person on the other end of protest where you can say, I'm going to put it out there. And I'm going to allow the viewer or the person that's going to connect with it to have their experience.
Julie Abajanik is the Associate Press Professor at the Columbus College of Art and Design. She's one of the professors that's helped with Protest the Project, which is happening at CCAD. This hour on All Sides Weekend, we are talking about protest, its history, its evolution, its impact, and the art of it. Joining me as well in studio, Bob Frakas, is a political science professor at Columbus State Community College and the editor-in-chief of the Columbus Free Press, plus someone who has protested for many years in Columbus. Thanks so much for joining the program, Bob.
Oh, glad to be here. It's a topic I've been long involved with.
When we're looking at this sort of, I guess when we're talking about iconography and messaging, how important do you think signs are to protests? How do you think that that sort of art and that messaging makes an impact when people are gathering and demonstrating?
Well, you know, the poster board, you know, with a wooden slat is iconic. You know, if you look back over the years, and in fact, my wife's father, we had him draw one. He had done graphic arts here at Ohio State. And it really looked like this 1930s Depression era, but it was basically the same thing. Somebody out there with their sign. The recent cover of the Free Press has a protester out there standing with his sign in front of the State House. Very stark, right to the point. And the article was on how they were attempting to criminalize dissent. And his sign spoke directly to that.
And I think it's so interesting because technology has evolved. The ways that protests are organized with technology has evolved. We'll be talking about that a little later in the hour. But this symbol, this concept of a poster board on a wooden slat has existed for more than 100 years. We see it going back so far because it's simple and it's powerful.
And again, prior to that, the Free Press, we consciously went to a broad street in honor of French revolutionaries, you know, where, you know, coming up from the sewer with a broadsheet denouncing the state. So we actually made our paper at various times when we came out for a couple years. It was nothing but a broadsheet, two sides to be held as a poster to get the message across.
Mm. I think it's also so appropriate that CCAD is doing this with students because young people are so often the people who are protesting. I mean, we're seeing that at noon today. It's a global protest. It was hard to book people for the show because everyone is working on it. And I think that we're seeing even more so today. There's so many young people who are trying to lead this, like Greta Thunberg, the Swedish 16-year-old, I believe, who is making those efforts. So that was particularly appropriate as well for CCAD.
Yeah, I mean, I think that our young people are just not afraid to stand up and really voice their opinion, especially with what's happening in the world. And they're seeing it and they're experiencing it and they realize it's their future. Mm. And they have to take hold of that. And they have to do whatever they can to, you know, bring awareness to those that haven't thought about it or it's never really been a concern. So it's for me, it's exciting because it's just exciting to see that they're just raring to go and ready to speak their voice. And as a faculty member, I feel like it's my job to help them do that.
Mm-hmm. Bob, you've been doing this for years. How do you channel that youthful energy but keep it going, you know, keep people going once they have, you know, maybe 9-to-5 jobs and don't have as much free time and maybe, as my mother would say, don't have the enthusiasm beat out of them yet?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of people have pondered this. Norman Thomas, the legendary Christian socialist who spoke at the first anti-war rally in 1965, said he always emphasized how much he enjoyed it, how much fun it was, mm-hmm. that it is, in fact, energizing to go forward with other people as a community for social justice. Mm-hmm. So although there were some bleak years, I'm reflecting on the 80s and the Reagan years.
When there wasn't as much protest?
There was protest, but the overwhelming forces, I was in the city of Detroit, there was so much bleakness, you know, we shifted from protesting to moving people back in their houses and hooking up their utilities. There seemed to be so much poverty and so much chaos. But 1999, I think, in Seattle, the battle for Seattle some 20 years ago, there was a notion that you could do this really through social media, and that not only did you need the signs, but you needed to have your own media, to use the internet, to use what are now we calling the new social media to get your message across, and that people should not only, be out there protesting, they should be covering themselves and controlling their own narrative.
Hmm. Do you see your students having that sense of individualism, you know, within this sort of project where they're trying to speak for themselves and really, own what they're saying?
I mean, yeah, for sure. I think they own it by the way they create their poster, mm-hmm. right? I mean, two people could be talking about the same thing and they were just lovely different visual ideas of what that is. And I think that's what would spark a lot of the conversations that the students would have between each other. Like, why do you feel about this? Why do you feel this way about this particular subject? Well, I feel this way about the particular subject. So this conversation would start to kind of develop between the two of them.
And it's so neat that can happen. That sort of dialogue can happen mm-hmm. when you're talking about something you care so deeply about. Because sometimes passion can kind of prevent discourse, right?
Right. And I think, too, when you're young, sometimes you're not sure if you do have others behind you that are feeling the same way. And I think that when they're in that community setting, it's a safe space to have a conversation and to know that it's okay to have that conversation. And as faculty members, we're there to help kind of perpetuate that activity to keep it going.
Julie Abajanek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, not a problem.
She's an associate professor at Columbus College of Art and Design and one of the creators of the Protest the Project that's happening and on exhibit now at CCAD. You can find out more about that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Bob Fetrakis is staying with us for the second segment of All Sides Weekend. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to All Sides Weekend. I am your host, Claire Roth, and we just heard a bit of Edwin Starr singing War. It's one of the most popular protest songs ever recorded, released in 1970 at the height of the counterculture era during the Vietnam War. Veterans of that war joined demonstrations at the time, and historians credit their appearance for helping turn public opinion against the war. We are talking about the history and the efficacy of protest and demonstration this hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. When has demonstration changed something? Have you taken part of a protest in Columbus that meant something to you? Please reach out to us at You can reach us at allsides@wosu.org. And still with us is Bob Fetrakis. He's the political science professor at Columbus State Community College and the editor-in-chief of the Columbus Free Press. He has been protesting for many, many years. And I'm wondering, Bob, when you look at the history of this country, what do you see as the most notable moments of protest? What are the most important ones that really change tides?
Well, every major struggle that has made this country more just came from intense protest. I mean, the right to vote, which came out of the Jacksonian period for white males, was one. The union movements, which were just brutal protest from 1877 to 1920 when we were industrializing, the railroad strike of 1877, the homestead strike of 1892, the Pullman strike of 1894. These were violent clashes before the state moved in and, you know, regulated and said workers by 36 under the Wagner Act and FDR actually had a right to protest. So the very right to protest was won through protest. And my favorite, right, the suffragettes. I mean, I tell my students to beware the passive voice. And then women were granted the right to vote. So, is that really how it happened? I thought they dressed in white and marched by the tens of thousands and chained themselves to the White House fence and then were adjudicated to be hysterical and mentally ill and put in hospitals and went on hunger strikes and had their teeth drilled out and were force-fed. And they were treated so brutally that it shocked the nations and won women the right to vote.
But if I may, how do you separate the chicken from the egg? How do we know that these protests aren't just a symptom of a feeling, a movement that's already underway? And well, actually, they're the instead of what you're saying, which is they're the catalyst of this change.
Well, the axioms of the movement from Frederick Douglass and other people, you know, power concedes nothing without power. I mean, without countervailing protest, is that like there's a status quo. People at the top of that structure are usually very comfortable. They don't sit around and go, oh, wow, we forgot to give the little women the right to vote, unless you press that issue. You know, we had, the four students who sat at Greensboro in 1960.
At the lunch counter.
Right, and again, the phrase is often used, the impossible will take a little longer,
yeah.
You know, referring to a classic song there by Billie Holiday and others. But I mean, over break, they said, hi, we've had apartheid since 1619. We're going to end it through direct action.
Mm.
And again, within, 4 years, by 1964, with the Civil Rights Act, that happened through nonviolent direct action and resistance. And it had been in place since 1619. At Jamestown. Also, the Vietnam War, I think, would have gone on in perpetuity. Many of these wars do, had there not been resistance. You raised the issue of the Vietnam veterans
mm-hmm.
and their famous group, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And one of the shocking things, when you knew the war was over, when those veterans were beaten by the Miami police for attempting to enter the Republican convention in 1972. I remember it. I was a senior in high school, and I couldn't believe they were beating veterans in wheelchairs. And again, the 10,000 students at 68 at the Democratic Party convention. I mean, sometimes we think, you know, there were hundreds of thousands there. There were 10,000 because the police were so brutal. But the result of seeing them beaten, you know, made that movement grow exponentially. You know, now the rallies are 100,000, 250,000. The Pentagon actually issued a report in 67 at the main rally, which said that there were so many people there in 67 when they tried to levitate the Pentagon is that they didn't have enough bullets to stop them. They could have taken over the Pentagon.
And let's talk about that pushback, because you're framing that pushback from authorities as almost essential to the protests working. And now we have a lot more, state sanctions, and they talk a lot about, for instance, the March on Washington, even the Women's March. You have to get permits. You have to essentially be stamped as okay by the government. So how much of a protest is the protest?
Well, I've been at some protests, including after the beating of protesters at the Republican convention in 2008. And then they created these free speech zones where you literally had to be, you know, almost full body searches, and then you entered a little cage. So I think tactics evolve, and the beauty of the social media. I mean, there was a period of time in the 1990s, I think 90% of the protest in this town, we knew about it, the free press. We help organize or participate. Now we're in this beautiful era that gives me great feelings where a protest will happen and I'll have missed it. It's like a flash mob, right? There was this protest of 500 people, you know, at the ICE office. And it's like, how did I miss that? Because I wasn't on my phone as much as these younger people. And they're doing a great job, and they're adapting the tactics. The mobile nature of the phones is also now the mobile nature of spontaneous protest, and on a grander scale, worldwide protest.
That's really interesting. I'm curious what you think makes protest most effective. What are the ingredients that means that change actually comes out of protest, as opposed to, you know, a lot of people get to express their feelings and then go home?
Well, I think the question of a clear message, what you're doing, Greta Thunberg there yesterday saying, you know, I want you to, you know, read the scientific studies, right? I mean, we're post-Renaissance, we're post-Reformation, we're post-Enlightenment, and we have a government and a president that denounces his own scientists. The Pentagon's Office of Risk Assessment says the number one threat to U.S. security is climate change. And you've got the commander-in-chief ignoring his own scientists. So the straightforward nature of the message, I think, is what makes it effective.
We are talking about protest this hour on All Sides Weekend. My guest, Bob Fitrakis, excuse me, I don't know why I keep stumbling over that. Fitrakis is a political science professor at Columbus State Community College. He's the editor-in-chief of the Columbus Free Press. If you want to join our conversation, please give us a call at 614-292-8513. Right now, we have Aaliyah on the line. Aaliyah, in Columbus, what would you like to add to the conversation today?
Hi, thanks for having me on. And it's Aaliyah.
Aaliyah, excuse me, Aaliyah, what would you like to join add to the conversation today?
Well, by the way, great discussion. Just wanted to say that up front. I am African-American, and I just wanted to point out kind of a flaw in the way Americans think about protests, particularly, at least the bee in my bonnet, is particularly around how we view African-American protests, starting with the civil rights movement.
Okay, what's that?
African-Americans in this country have literally been protesting since we were brought here as slaves. Not just nonviolent protesting triggered by the civil rights movement in the 1960s. We have been setting fires in kitchens in the slave house. We have been taking up guns against the police, whether we're talking about police bombing streets in Alabama, you know, in towns in Alabama or whatever from the Deep South. I don't really have my facts in front of me, but I do just want to add that protest isn't just nonviolent in this country. Like,
it's also direct action.
It's also direct action. And direct action is what won us the right to vote. It's what won us the right to humanity. I feel like the nonviolent protest is just what made it acceptable for us to protest. So,
well, thank you so much for joining the conversation, Aliyah. I really appreciate your comment. And please speak to Aliyah's point, Bob. Direct action is an important part of this, of the stew, if you will, but maybe it's not as easily swallowable by most of society. So we don't think about it. We don't talk about it as much as we talk about, you know, the classic kind of nonviolent protests.
Sure. And Nat Turner, I mean, we've had open rebellions. Our Constitution was precipitated by Daniel Shea and Shea's rebellion, how those revolutionary war heroes were treated by the state of Massachusetts. And again, the Black Panthers, which were the Black Panther party for self-defense, which I joined one of their auxiliaries at, when I was in college as a quote, White Panther. Yeah. And, you know, we felt that in many cases, people had a right to defend themselves. So, I mean, there's some Francis Fox Piven, you know, the great sociologist, said that the only time there's been real advancement is when there's been some sort of open rebellion that gets the attention of the government. But so I really think in a lot of his narrative, because often those in power is going to say it's a riot, right? These people rioted for no reason. So it's a question of long-term strategy as well as your tactics. And I think nonviolence works, but only because if it's a mass movement, there's always the threat of violence if the government becomes repressive, because the repression will lead to an actual rebellion. So they've actually got to cost calculate, you know, what will be the cost to this society if people rise up and it becomes violent. So you can't separate the two. I mean, places burned after Martin Luther King was dead. It would have been much better had we settled many of those things, and a few things like apartheid was done through legislation, but it was so long overdue. So,
it's a combination of those things.
Right, absolutely.
And multiple sides of that coin, I suppose.
Right, and there's a fundamental rule of protesting is you never take people out and expose them to police or state violence if they're not prepared or if you can't protect them.
Mm. We are talking about protests this hour on All Sides Weekend. My guest, Bob Fetrakis, is a political science professor at Columbus State Community College, editor-in-chief at the Columbus Free Press. And joining us now is Pat Morita, an activist, a Sierra Club volunteer who has been working here in Columbus for years on various social action causes. Thank you so much for joining the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I've been listening to the program. It's been very interesting.
Yeah, please share.
I wanted to add that sociologically, there has never been a successful social movement without civil disobedience. Now, that doesn't say it has to be, you know, violent or it must be nonviolent, but that's unless things are disrupted, unless business as usual is disrupted, their social change just doesn't happen. And I'm looking now at Greta Thunberg, and she was one person, and she started a school strike in front of her school over a year ago on Fridays, protesting the fact that her government wasn't doing enough and was actually contributing, the Swedish government was actually contributing to global
climate
warming,
change, yeah.
Climate change, and so forth. So that was really, well, you see how that's grown to the protest that's happening worldwide today, the climate strike. It's just amazing how what one person can do. So I don't want anyone that's listening to this broadcast to think that there isn't something that each one can do.
Well, and I think that this is an interesting question. When you talk about the disruption of business as usual, because a lot of times when you see effective protests, you see side by side some sort of disruption to literal businesses, right? There's boycotts or sit-ins. And I'm wondering if protests can really be effective if there isn't another branch of it that is going to hurt people in their wallets somewhere along the line, because that's oftentimes when people sit up and start to pay attention.
Yeah, and I think the Stonewall riot is a classic case in point, is that, you know, it's routine. We're going to go out and assault, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual, queer people. It's what we do on Friday night as New York police. And when they fought back, that was disruptive to the social order. But after a long period of time, I mean, now if you look here in Columbus, you know, on the Stonewall rally and, you know, March, Gay Pride March, you've got virtually every major corporation out there. You know, they realize that you couldn't exclude, you know, 10, 15, 20% of the society. It made no sense. It was bad business. But originally, there was no problem with it until there was a riot. And a lot of times, you know, they don't refer back to that original intent. And some of that came up with the Black Pride 4. And I was involved as an attorney with some of their defense work. But and again, a lot of people will say there's still fringe elements, including, you know, the African-Americans within the gay, lesbian, bisexual movement that still aren't being treated fair.
And that also speaks to the sort of long arc you have to look at with a lot of these movements. I mean, Stonewall was decades and decades ago, and it wasn't until 2015 that same-sex marriage was legalized. And that's only one aspect of it. I mean, that's a tiny aspect of a much broader coalition of concerns that those groups have. And so I think that that's an interesting thing to look at as well. I'm wondering how you get protest to turn into institutional change. And I'm thinking of, for instance, the Tea Party, which started as a lot of protests, but then converted into a lot of political power, where they actually had some of their members elected to office, which is a pretty dang straightforward conversion of protest to, you know, institutional change.
Of course, there was a battle within the Tea Party, because a lot of that, the argument from certain elements of the Tea Party, it was turned into AstroTurf. The Koch brothers poured a ton of money into the Tea Party, which was a legitimate grassroots uprising against the subsidies and the bailouts of the bank that were, you know, quote, too big to fail. So it had a much broader spectrum, from libertarians on the rights to anti-tax conservative to leftists. And you always have to worry about the co-optation, you know, where the money's coming from and what are the demands. Mike Zarzano, who is part of that movement, when he showed up one day and suddenly there were people that claimed to be on the payroll and directors and not saying where the money came from, and pulled out something saying, we're also, not only are we against these bailouts to the banks and to GM, but we're also against unionization of teachers. And he was like, you know, where'd that demand come from? So there's always going to be attempts to co-op all movements. So people need to be on guard and to make sure their original impulse, you know, stays on point.
So, yeah. So when I was talking about Greta being one person, I was thinking also about Mahatma Gandhi, who led the protest against the British in India. And he was started out as one person with a march to the sea to collect salt, because the British had a tax on salt, and they refused to allow the Indian people to actually harvest their own salt. And so he started out as one person, was joined by a few. But the time they reached the sea to illegally harvest the salt, there were tens of thousands. And he also boycotted. Boycotts are a very important part of social protest. Boycotted British goods. Say, spin your own homespun, you know, your cloth. Don't buy the British with the value added. And this is what happens a lot worldwide, is that rich nations go into poor countries and they take out the resources, the minerals or whatever, and then they bring them back, and the value added or the things that are manufactured from are not done in the country where the resources were originally found.
We're talking about protest this hour. My guest, Pat Morita, and Bob Fatrakis. We are going to be back with both of them talking more about Ohio-specific protests. If you've participated in a protest or a demonstration here in Columbus, we want to hear from you on the impact you feel it's had. You can give us a call at 614-292-8513. We'll be back in just a moment with more All Sides Weekend. Welcome back to All Sides Weekend. I'm your host, Claire Roth. We are coming in on the sounds of Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, which of course is about the Kent State shootings of 1970. Those protests, though, were far from the end of student demonstration in Ohio. In just about 20 minutes, 15 minutes, young people across the world will be taking to the streets for the global climate strike. That includes students who will be demonstrating at the Ohio State House downtown. This hour, we're talking about protest and its impact on culture, policy, our country at large. Still with us is Bob Fatrakis, political science professor at Columbus State Community College and editor-in-chief of the Columbus Free Press. Also with us, Pat Morita, an activist, Sierra Club volunteer. Pat, environmental protests have existed for decades. Sometimes it can feel like there's not much headway being made. We're just about to see another student-led protest coming up in 15 minutes. You know, what change can we really expect from this sort of demonstration?
So I think it calls attention both to the public and to the elected officials that, hey, maybe if you don't vote for the environment, you might not be elected next time. And it tells the people, hey, get out there and vote. Look at how your legislator is voting, and let's see, let's make a change. Because often it is governments. Now at the protest today in Columbus is at the State House, but sometimes it's governments who actually stand as a buffer between the citizens. And right now the power structure lies in corporate. International corporations, they have more wealth and more power often than most nations. So so we also need to take that protest, besides being just towards the government, we need to also look at power structures.
Well, and that's an interesting point, Bob, where a lot of times these protests are not necessarily just against the government. I mean, while that might be the kind of proximate aim, there's trying to do a larger difference in the culture, trying to convince not just the government that it should change, but other people that they should change. I'm thinking of almost like Occupy Wall Street. Before then, you know, we didn't really say the 99%. And after that, it became a whole, not sure, a new way of thinking, but certainly a more ubiquitous way of thinking about wealth inequality.
Well, it's entered our society. All of my students, you know, are familiar with the term and use it quite regularly, where, I mean, it's a form of class-based progressive populism that the 1% and really, you know, the 1% of that 1%, but the 1% is dictating to us, you know, how the world is run in an exploitive manner. And that came out of Occupy. And by the way, Columbus had the longest standing Occupy of any city. And it was on the sidewalk in front of the State House. I was one of their attorneys, and there were a few attempts to shut it down unsuccessfully. In fact, Tim Chavez, I'm sure he won't, at one point they shut it down and it moved to a commercial parking lot that an activist and his family owned and to keep it alive. And I also was there for the Reoccupy. You know, right outside Wall Street in the park, and oh, the brutality of the New York police and making sure that park would not be reoccupied was really stunning. Some of the most violent actions I'd ever seen by, I mean, people were being body slammed by police in riot gear.
I mean, there's also when we talk about crowd control, you know, Kent State is obviously a very, very extreme example. But it's this interesting question of what defines a protest versus a riot, for instance, because, of course, when you get a lot of people who are very passionate in one area, it can be dangerous. And so trying to, I guess, balance those two things of making sure people are safe and then, of course, making sure people have their right to assembly.
And again, I mean, we have a rule. If police show up in riot gear, there's going to be a riot, because usually if they've dressed up like that, that comes from an order that this protest somehow is beyond the pale or won't be tolerated. One of my favorite protests by the anti-racist action group, who had a national conference, was right here at OSU. On one side of the street, there was one police officer and one car for the OSU police. On the other side of the street, and there were 60 Columbus police in riot gear. And we wisely knew if we stayed on this side of the street with our chants and protest, which in part were against police brutality, and part of Cop Watch protesting police behavior on campus, we were perfectly fine. So the OSU police did not see basically a student-led protest in any way as a threat. But the other side of the street, the other side of High Street, you know, they had full riot gear.
Yeah.
You were talking, too, about the concept of Columbus having an outpost of Occupy Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this city takes part of national protests. You know, we've seen that with the Women's March. We're seeing it today. But we also have specific protests right here. I mean, you were talking about, you know, a protest can kind of crop up at 500 people and you miss it. And I'm wondering what you feel like in Columbus are some of the more notable protests, either Columbus specific or not, that have shaped the activist community in this city.
Well, one of the ones that I was very proud we participated in, which came from Columbus, is the Klan and the Nazis used to come on Martin Luther King's birthday every year in the 1990s. And at a certain point, black activists said, why don't we go to their towns? So we actually hired private investigators who were black, many former police, who found out where these 8 Klan and Nazi leaders lived, who always hid behind sheets and hoods. And we actually organized buses and went to their house to let them know we know where they live. The FBI actually called me up and said, look, 5 of them have already fled the state. Right? They weren't really from here. Could you call this off? And 2 of them weren't home. Only one was. And there was confrontation in Coshocton. But that was organized first with rally after rally in Columbus to counter-protest. And then in a certain protest, like, why don't we go and let them know we know who they are? And one person, you know, ended up, you know, his neighbors had no idea. Many of them were black, that he was in the Klan.
So when I spoke to both of you before you started the show, you said, well, we've seen each other at many, many protests. There's obviously a very active protest community, activist community, but how do you reach beyond that, beyond flash in the pan moments like the Women's March of 2016? You know, how do you get to the point where you actually include more than just the usual suspects that are almost always turning up? Pat?
So, well, that's an interesting question. We feel that we are preaching not just to the choir, but we are actually preaching to a room full of preachers, so that we go out there and we try to recruit new folks to come in and join us and help us. And usually successful social movements only take between 5% and 15% of the population to agree.
That's interesting.
And that so that you don't need 1,000 people to come to your planning meeting or whatever it is you're having. You need those 1,000 people to come out like today. When you see a smaller group of organizers, they can be really powerful. In fact, there's a statement that Margaret Mead had said that never doubt what the effectiveness of a small community to make change. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has a small group of people.
Bob, how do you handle that question of the question of preaching to the choir or preaching to other preachers?
Well, at a certain point at the Free Press, we realized that we weren't in touch with everyone, that there were spontaneous communities, particularly as the technology was changing and the ability to instant message and, you know, Instagrams, et cetera. We actually created a Second Saturday Salon, which Pat attends regularly, among the older activists, but really would reach out, feed, and give people space to talk. So we had them. We invited them in. We fed them. You know, we shared with them and created a community. And lo and behold, young people we didn't know began to show up. And, you know, we turned the mic over to them. And we also created two low-powered radio stations that don't have, you know, a wide signal, but it allows people with different perspectives to come in and do what they need to do. But we still, to this day, and it really came out of the protest of the 2004 election. We said, you know, who are these people? I once showed up after the 2004 election demanding a recount, showing up at a rally thinking it's freezing, right? It's 10 degrees. There's going to be five people there. I'm going to be the speaker. I'm going to get sick and hoarse. And there were 1,000 people there.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, where did they come from? And I realized it was the internet. Also, when we stopped the attack at Iraq in 1997, it's one of the first time we put out this big call on the internet to, you know, colleges throughout the Midwest and Wayne State and Detroit. And we didn't know who was going to show up, but we were thinking maybe we'll get 50 people. But again, you know, there's 600 people show up, and all of that really was, you know, they weren't reading the paper quite as much, but they sure
but they're on their internet.
Were on the internet.
Well, before we go, I want to also talk about how do protests avoid reinforcing already existing divisions? I mean, you saw that with some of the NFL protesting, with the kneeling that Colin Kaepernick and other football players did. Maybe that reached new people. I mean, it was a very nonviolent, very, I don't want to say passive form of protest, but it existed, you know, it wasn't obtrusive. But then it turned into this firestorm that seemed to just reinforce divisions that already existed. So is there a way for protests to really reach out? Or is it just about riling up the people that might already agree with you?
Well, you know, I think first, I think Colin Kaepernick is a patriot. One of the points he made is that there's racist lyrics in the national anthem. And there are very specific.
But speaking to this question of how are they going to reach across, I mean, setting that example aside, we've only got about a minute. So.
Well, I think the notion is, you know, you can't concede the flag. You can't concede the national symbols. Is that peace is, in fact, patriotic. Global change and listening to scientists is patriotic and in the best interest of our country.
And who put out that negative message, you know, that's something that it, I think there's corporate interests that perhaps put out some negative feedback on Colin Kaepernick's kneeling.
Well, Pat Morita, thank you so much for joining us today. She's an activist and Sierra Club volunteer. And thank you so much, Bob Fetrakis, political science professor at Columbus State Community College and editor-in-chief of the Columbus Free Press. Thank you both for joining us today.
All right. It was a pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This has been All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News. The All Sides staff includes producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon. All Sides interns include Atia Tour, Tatiana Woodall, and Bobby Gerberic, with video production by Rich and Amber Blue. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. Have a great weekend.